for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, I'll be talking with Dr. Hayward Ewert, the author of Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse, which is out now on Loving Healing Press. A former licensed psychologist, Dr. Hayward Ewert is an active priest with the Catholic Charismatic Church. He lives in Jacksonville, Florida, where he continues his 30-year counseling career and also serves as president of St. James the Elder Theological Seminary. Dr. Ewert has served as a professor at the university level, has conducted a number of continuing education programs, and has been an active member of groups advocating victims' rights, especially the victims of child and domestic abuse. He has written and spoken widely on the subject of abuse and maintains that domestic violence victims are groomed in childhood to accept abuse later in life. So thank you so much for joining us on the program today, Dr. Ewert.
Thank you. Been looking forward to it.
Me too. So I have to say congratulations on your new book. And I'm wondering if this is actually your first published book.
Well, I had a book published back in 1976, but that's old and yellow and dusty.
I'm sure the content isn't, but I know what you mean.
Yes.
So what led you to actually writing this particular book at this time?
I saw a great need for an understanding in this area of abuse. There is a terrible lack, an alarming lack, of professional therapists who are skilled in treating people who are victims of abuse, whether they're adult survivors of child abuse or rape victims or any other kind of abuse, domestic violence, and so forth. Very, very few people are skilled. And I felt that two things were needed, a book for the professional community and one that would also educate victims themselves so that they could understand why they feel the way they do.
Mm-hmm. This is all kinds of abuse that you're talking about then in this book.
Yes, everything from victims of crime, but mainly the book focuses on child abuse.
Okay.
And what the abuse does to the psyche or the soul, if you will, and what permanent implants abuse makes in the developmental process.
Okay.
So that these are long-lasting effects. In fact, if a child is abused, the effect of it lasts his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main point that I make, or one of the main points that I make in the book.
So we are seeing really so much in media today, books being written on the issue of abuse, and really that this is coming into, I don't know, we're hearing more and more about it. I'm wondering if you have any statistics on really the prevalence of child abuse that is going on today?
Well, of course they vary widely because we don't know for sure whether all of the abuse is really reported.
Right.
And chances are that it's not.
Right.
We assume it's not. But roughly, one in four boys is abused and one in three girls.
Isn't
so girls are abused more than boys, but boys are right behind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your premise is that if you were abused as a child, that chances are you have been really abused your whole life.
It sets you up. Child abuse sets you up to be a victim for the rest of your life. And the way it does that is that it implants a message of being a less than, of having something wrong with you, of having something deep, dark, and bad deep within you that caused that person to abuse you. And the most damaging message of all is that one comes to feel that this is all I deserve in life.
Mm.
And that's why little girls who are abused will most often marry an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
Because she will not seek a mate or a partner who exceeds what she believes she deserves.
Do you think in most cases it would be impossible for that girl, when she does grow into adulthood, to even see a bigger vision for herself?
Well, that's one reason I wrote the book.
Yeah.
So that young women and older women, too, would be very careful about choosing a mate and would come to understand themselves. And the voices they're really hearing when they're telling themselves, I don't deserve any better, and I am obligated to be abused because this is my role in life.
Mm-hmm.
If I can get them to the point where they can recognize whose voice they're really listening to, rather than their own, because it's not their own, it's the voice of the original abuser.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting? And from what I understand, you say that from that original abuse, basically a person's choices through the rest of their life will always be skewed from that abuse experience.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, you have a term called the adopted self. Tell us a little bit more about what that means.
Well, this really brings up a whole new model of personality development.
Mm-hmm.
The well-known so-called theorists in the field, like Freud and Paget and Erickson and Maslow, they all talk in terms of what ought to be. And I talk in terms in describing the developmental process that I think is real. I describe what actually happens in life far too often. So that what happens really is that a person's self-concept is based on nothing more than the opinions we hear about ourselves in the growing up process, plus the experimentation we go through in adolescence, the teen years, and we combine the two and we think that's who we really are.
Mm.
Now, the problem is that that's a false idea. It's based on nothing but opinion and experimentation. But I call that faulty conclusion the adopted self. And I believe that most of the population, if not all of the population, really has a lack of understanding as to who they really are, what their abilities are, what their calling in life is, if you will.
Mm.
And most people tragically go to their graves without ever knowing what they were supposed to do in this life, what their purpose really was.
That really is a tragedy, really. So is your book, is your book then basically laying out how to discover, I don't know what your term is, but to find that authentic self?
Exactly, yes. And the way you find it is by turning around and taking a look back and asking yourself, were my parents really right about me in what they communicated to me? Were my teachers really correct about what they said? Were my friends correct in what they said about me? And what are their qualifications? What are their credentials to communicate to me who I am? So they re-examine all the messages that they've received throughout their lives and try to form new conclusions based on reality rather than somebody else's opinion. And by the way, abuse is the strongest communication there is.
That is very interesting. That's an extremely powerful, powerful statement. Did you come up with that, Dr. York?
Yes.
Can you explain that a little more?
Abuse has the power to mangle the developing personality and derail the developmental process so that the person will grow up having very little idea of who they really are, what their potentials may be, and feeling less than, feeling like a second-class citizen, and feeling they don't deserve much out of life.
Mm.
the feeling is so strong that if a woman marries an abuser, or these days shacks up with an abuser, and it gets so bad that she finally gets away, she will typically go to a shelter where she is provided for in a very meager way. And if she has any children, they will be provided for too in a very meager way. And then once she leaves the shelter, she will either return to the same abuser or a worse one.
Mm.
And the reason she will go to a worse one is because the prior abuser confirmed what she already thought, and that is, this is all I deserve.
Right. So why an abuser that is even worse? Just to reconfirm that, or?
Well, she doesn't do it consciously.
Yeah.
But deeply implanted in her way of thinking, she believes that she doesn't deserve anything better. And the other thing that happens, too, is that predators are like hawks. They can spot wounded prey from a very long distance. Abusers can easily spot a woman who has already been wounded. And it's the same phenomenon that we see with women who are raped. They say raped once, raped again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. And that's because there is a woundedness that another predator can easily spot.
Isn't that interesting? Because it isn't something that's conscious, you know, that you could look at someone and really just obviously point out, but there is something subliminal, and I've heard this before too, that, you know, in that victim-predator dynamic, there is something extremely powerful.
Yes, indeed, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. So what are the present models? What are they doing with victims of abuse in the whole recovery phase that maybe you don't specifically agree with or you think that really isn't helpful in the long run?
Well, they're not doing anything. there is almost nothing being done in the treatment of abused women. Now, as in public shelters, they have group meetings, but more often than not, they are run by paraprofessionals who, in some fashion, really put across an anti-male message so that the victim is taught really to avoid all men because all men are bad. And they don't get treated for what the actual issues are.
The core issues.
That's it. Mm. They are not treated in the core issues, and that's because there are so few people in my field who understand what the core issues are and what to treat.
Mm-hmm.
So almost nothing is being done.
What about one-on-one therapy? How?
Well, that could help if the therapist understands the dynamics of abuse. Mm-hmm. But there again, that's the reason I wrote the book.
Right. Right.
It's both for therapists and for victims.
Yes. Yeah, you really have presented an incredible amount of information and very useful practical information in this book for everybody.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm interested to know the connection between symptoms and treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and the similarities or differences with your type of treatment for abuse.
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is a natural outcome of very severe abuse, especially rape and extreme physical abuse. And most people think of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence of being at war, in an actual war, as a military person.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some people whose lives have been a war, and they suffer symptoms which are the same as those who have been in actual war events in foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
PTSD is very often found in victims of abuse. It's something that needs to be understood in the educational process of any therapist who is going to attempt to treat abuse, because you cannot treat abuse effectively without an understanding of how to treat PTSD.
You know, many people view addictions as a way to cope with early childhood abuse, and even people that are diagnosed with PTSD, a lot of times they are covering up their pain through addiction.
Indeed.
Yeah, so in your professional experience, what is the incidence of like secondary addictions like this, and what are other ways that people are attempting to hide that pain?
Well, I have found in my research that 90% of the women who are active in Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, 90% of the women are victims of sexual abuse, and half of those are victims of incest. And with men, it's about 80%.
Is that right?
Yes. And yet, at an AA meeting, this is something that the rules of the group prevent you from discussing.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring up any core issues in your addiction, you will be shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't throw you out, but they'll come close to it. And they will tell you at these 12-step meetings that if you bring up a subject like your early childhood abuse or your violent husband or wife or whatever, they will tell you you're just making excuses for your own addiction, or you're living in the problem and not in the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have these slogans to not just cover up the core issues, but to dispense with them. And in my opinion, that's the reason that the recovery rate in AA is so low. It's 3.7%.
Yeah. Yes, the recidivism rate for 12-step programs is very high.
And if you do nothing about your alcoholism, you have a 30% chance of recovery.
Oh,
so
gosh.
You're in effect, if you look at just the statistics, you're reducing your chances of recovery by going to AA.
Isn't that fascinating? Oh, that really puts a different perspective on 12 steps.
Sure does.
Yeah, it really does. And I just imagine if someone that is going through abuse like that, that is in a group setting, that brings it up and is shot down by the group, I just wonder how traumatic that really is, and if it really drives that trauma deeper and deeper.
It will. The worst possible thing that you can do to an abuse victim is to minimize it, or to say, why can't you just get over it, or to ignore it, or, you know, just shove it aside. That does exactly what you said. It drives the wound even deeper.
Do you think that there is any place then for the 12-step programs that we're seeing today, or do you think that there's a major rehaul that needs to be done on them?
Well, the statistics bear out the fact that a major overhaul is really needed in the concept of recovery. Mm-hmm. The programs treat addictions as though they have just arisen in a vacuum, as though they just came from nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never believed that, not ever. There is a cause for everything. And while it's true that once you have become addicted to a substance, whether it's some drug or alcohol, which is itself a drug, once you have become addicted, you must abstain. But here is the catch, that once you have the core issue by the tail, and you understand what got you started in the first place, you have a much better chance of abstaining. Your chances skyrocket. And in order to test this out, I don't need to prove it to myself, but I need to prove it to the world, I'm going to start some groups, maybe as early as next week, where I'm going to treat abuse victims and addicts in the same group.
That's fantastic.
And there will be an overlap probably 80 to 90% of the time.
I imagine so. Are you trying to design a new model? Is this somewhat of an experiment then?
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very sure of what I'm doing.
Yes, yes.
Yes. But yes, I would have to say, and it's an experiment. I don't know how well it will sell.
Uh-huh.
But I think if a few people try it and find that they're actually getting help and feeling better,
mm-hmm.
and feeling better about themselves and making progress with their lives, I think that it will begin to catch on and spread.
Yes. I think your message is so empowering to people. You know, if you are getting down to this core issue, and it just, you know, one last thing about the whole model of the 12-step program, and a lot of people have a problem with having to basically accept that they're powerless. You know, that
yeah.
that is a part of that program. What are
yeah.
your opinions on that?
Well, I believe that it is necessary to admit that you're powerless over the drug,
mm.
because that's what addiction is.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really just admitting you're an addict.
Yes.
Where they fall short is they don't give any reason for your becoming
okay.
an addict.
Yeah.
It's as though it just grew up from nowhere.
Yeah.
And suddenly appeared one day.
And being an addict obviously is not a good thing. More of a bad
right.
thing. And, you know, mm-hmm. we can look at the title of your book, Am I Bad? You know.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody who is abused feels that they are a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like they're bad.
Isn't that amazing to think of how many people are walking around in society today without going through their head?
Yes, it's alarming.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any greater need in the whole field of mental health than to focus on this pandemic of abuse which is going on.
Mm.
And I find it astounding that you can rarely find a therapist who understands these issues.
Yes. Yeah, it really does not make a lot of sense.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is the priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Dr. Hayward Ewer, author of Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. You can find out more about Dr. Ewert through his website, childtoadultvictim.com. And those words are all separated with a hyphen. I'm wondering, you know, with the rampant abuse that's going on and the lack of proper therapy and proper recovery models, you know, we're living in times that are very, very tumultuous, very traumatic. Just turning the TV on, you know, we are being bombarded with a lot of negativity. And I'm wondering if you think that there is a connection with the state of a lot of people's mental health and what we're seeing as an outward projection in the world today.
Well, some of the TV programs, and especially the ones that I watch, I love to watch Law and Order, Criminal Intent,
mm-hmm.
and Special Victims Unit.
Mm-hmm.
And those programs, to me, are very plausible.
Mm.
Most of the stories are fictional, but they're based on what is happening in society today on a very, very large scale.
Mm.
So in this case, the TV programs are reflecting what's really happening in our society. Now, in most cases, TV programs and commercials and advertising are all based on some kind of an agenda,
mm-hmm.
where they're selling not just a product, but a value. And I call this the age of sloganism, where they put a slogan out there that sounds good and everybody buys it. Slogans like, I'm worth it.
Mm.
And, if it feels good, do it. And get yourself free and all these kinds of things.
That probably appeal to a part of us that don't feel that way.
Yes, but the problem is that young people now ever since the 60s, when all this started, the plummeting of societal values and the discounting of marriage or the sanctity of marriage and things of that kind, and the sanctity of life has been devalued. It all began in the 60s. I mean, I can almost remember. It kind of started with Twiggy, where the advertising world introduced this stick figure whose name was Twiggy, and I happened to be in the advertising field at the time.
Okay, interesting.
And we were all aghast, and we thought it was a joke.
Really?
We thought it was black humor.
Oh.
And yet it turned out to be the standard.
Yes, shaped a generation, and then from then on. Mm-hmm.
And now we have anorexia and bulimia
mm-hmm.
all over the place. And by the way, nobody knows how to treat those either.
That's really true. I think you're right. How many incidents of eating disorders do you see? I mean, this is just an addiction just like anything else, any other addiction.
Well, I've seen quite a few. Mm. And I find them very easy to treat.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little more about that. I'm sure that some of the listeners today have either, issues themselves, because eating disorders, there's a varying degree of eating disorders. And,
mm-hmm.
or also, maybe they know somebody that is touched with an eating disorder.
Well, the intents are different between bulimia and anorexia.
Mm.
Bulimia is a form of weight control to adhere to the false model of beauty that we adhere to as a society. And that's what powers bulimia.
Mm.
it's a way to have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Or it's a way to eat your cake but not eat it.
But not, right.
So I had one woman. And on our second visit, I mean, she had been plagued with bulimia for 8 years
mm.
and seen I don't know how many doctors.
Oh, gosh.
But on our second visit, I said, what kinds of values about eating were attached to your meal times when you were a child? And she said, well, my mother would always tell us to eat everything on our plate.
Mm-hmm.
But then she would also tell us that we're getting too fat.
Mm.
And I said, well, then for you, bulimia is a way to solve the problem, isn't it?
Mm.
And she just froze because it hit her like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
And she saw that was the dynamic that was going on. She was trying to obey her mother.
Yeah, so many years later.
That's right. And she was in her 40s at that time.
Oh, wow.
And she never had to come back for another visit. So that was bulimia cured of 8 years duration in two visits.
And many other therapists.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many more.
Well, congratulations, and really, that's wonderful, wonderful story. Now, how is that different from anorexia?
Now, with anorexia, that is a suicide attempt.
Really?
By the installment plan. I mean, with anorexics, they believe that they don't deserve to live. And someone has told them that in some way, a parent or a guardian, someone very, very important in their lives.
Mm.
There's a case that I describe in my book where this anorexic young woman was almost dead and was in the hospital with tubes in her arms and monitors and everything else. They were trying to keep her alive, and her mother, who was the real cause of the condition of anorexia that her daughter had, mother walked into the hospital room and said, if you can just get over this, then I can die in peace.
Oh, gosh. Mm.
And so this child had been taught in various ways. There's subversive, twisted, disguised communications,
mm-hmm.
but yet the point gets across that you don't deserve to live.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if there is a connection to that, you don't deserve to live, to abuse in the form of either neglect or rejection, which some people typically wouldn't characterize that as abuse, but I know you do, and it's a very strong form of abuse.
Yes. They certainly, the child does get that message that they don't deserve anything, and they don't deserve, it can be as strong as you don't deserve to live at all. But at the very least, they get the message that you're not worth much.
Mm.
And that's very true. I mean, that message is just about guaranteed. Now, one way that some women, some mothers will try to guarantee that they always have a live-in servant is to convince a son or daughter that there's something wrong with them and they can't make it in the world on their own, that they need mother. And that's a guarantee that that child will never marry, but will hang around mother and serve mother their whole lives.
Isn't that fascinating?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be conveyed in ways that are quite disguised, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. They're disguised, but there is a communication style between a parent and his child, which is very, very powerful.
Mm.
And even though it would seem distorted, and if somebody overheard it, they may not get it, but the child gets the message.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine in a relationship of that parent-child that is, I mean, that is the formative relationship that, I mean, that is just astounding. I am really just shocked by the strength that relationship can hold, you know, years and years later in life, that there still is that, maybe it's that little child within.
Exactly. That little child never goes away.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little child in 90-year-old people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little boy in every man and a little girl in every woman.
Mm-hmm.
And with a loud voice. And when that voice is heard, and it is heard, we have to ask ourselves, where did that voice come from? How did it get there?
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that kind of voice?
Mm-hmm.
Now, who gave me these ideas?
Yeah.
Who gave me these ideas about me?
Right.
And are they correct? But very few people ever do that. They just go along and they obey the voice of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And they, as I say, most people go to their graves having no idea what they could have done with their lives or what they should have done with their lives.
Mm-hmm. And what you're presenting here and your model is really, in your opinion, the way out of that, into recovery and into a fulfilling life.
Yes. You have
Fantastic.
To turn back and look back and examine all the forms of communication that you received about yourself during your formative years,
mm-hmm.
and reevaluate them.
Mm-hmm.
And ask yourself, was my mother correct about me? Was my father correct about me? Were my teachers correct about me? And how did they know?
Right.
You know, what makes them the world's greatest psychiatrist?
Right.
To tell me who I am.
When they, in their own turn, were probably have, you know, their own issues with their own parents. So it just gets passed on from generation.
It does.
Yeah, so this is really a healing on multiple levels when you think about it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the wonderful part, the wonderful side of it is that when I get a group of women together, and because most abuse victims who are willing to come for help are women, men usually won't come. That male pride thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get a group of women together and we have regular group meetings and they start to attain power from each other and through the understandings that they develop,
mm-hmm.
it's just the most rewarding and most beautiful thing in the world to see.
Yeah, I imagine.
I had one woman come to me just as a member of a group. She had a background as a psychiatric nurse, and she became so empowered and so set free that she became my co-therapist in the group.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. What a transformation.
Yes. And that makes it so worthwhile.
That is so inspiring. I know that people listening today, I mean, will just find such inspiration in that. That really is powerful. Really is powerful.
There is hope.
There, yes. Then that's a big part of your message is hope.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. You have a very interesting chapter in your book that deals with school abuse. And this is really something that we don't hear that much about. I'd like for you to maybe go into that a little bit and the effects that school abuse and abuse that is happening with teachers, that sort of thing, with children, what the effects are.
Well, most of the abuse in school is verbal abuse in the form of giving the child false information about himself or herself.
Mm.
Teachers being biased for whatever reason against a given child and believing that they know this child as a little person but not really knowing the child at all and not looking deeper. So teachers need to be extremely careful what they communicate to children,
mm-hmm.
because most of the abuse is through what the teacher says and how the teacher treats the children, especially when you get into 9th and 10th grades. You'll find that, and I have experienced it personally, that children from wealthier families are treated much more favorably by teachers than are children who are victims of generational poverty.
Mm, that is
there is
so
a
sad.
Huge difference.
Yeah.
And so now children who are victims of generational poverty already carry a sense of shame.
True. Mm-hmm.
And a teacher has almost as much power as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
So a teacher can easily reinforce that shame by not giving that child due attention or the extra attention that the child really craves.
Right, right.
And sometimes teachers don't understand why children are acting up. Sometimes they need some attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way they know to get it is to act up.
And so even at the 9th and 10th grades, this is a time that those core issues are still being formulated or they're being driven down deeper into the psyche.
That's right. And it's also at the time when teens are rotating various trial personalities to see which one will please the group and lead to acceptance by the peers so that that they are open to criticism by teachers because they might be one person one day and another person the next.
Right.
And either way, it's not the real person. They're only experimenting to find some front something they can present as themselves to be accepted by the group.
By the group. Isn't that interesting? Mm. Wow. And so that puts even another spin or, another explanation of that adopted self that we were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the second part of forming the adopted self. Part number one is the opinions we absorb in childhood. And part number two is the experience of the teenage years with their trial personalities. Add the two together, and that equals the adopted self.
That is.
And most people carry that concept to their graves.
Right, and never know who they really truly are.
Exactly.
What advice do you have for parents to address that issue of potential verbal abuse or that kind of communication in school?
To think very long and hard before they speak to a child regarding any character trait or even behaviors, and never to put down a child, never to insult a child, and certainly never to strike a child, because, as I say, abuse, whether it's verbal or whether it's physical, is the strongest communication possible and the most negative possible.
Mm-hmm.
So every time that you even look at a child with contempt, you are implanting an idea in that growing psyche.
Gosh,
that there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I'm off track. I'm not fitting in with what I'm supposed to be, you know. So
that is so powerful. And
parents need to realize how extremely vulnerable children are and be very, very careful what they say.
Mm-hmm. And the effects of shame are very abusive, and a lot of people don't make that connection, I don't think.
Right. Mm. That's true. Shame is an indication that one has been abused, and the most widespread shame that I've seen is in situations of generational poverty.
Mm-hmm.
With the inner city ghettos and things like that. You would think that the children would be hostile, but the children are not. The children have a sense of shame about them.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they get to be teens, they tend to be hostile at least sometimes as they're rotating their personalities and trying to get accepted into a peer group.
Mm-hmm.
So there we have a different cultural process going on, but the dynamics are the same.
Mm-hmm.
That abuse produces shame, and so does neglect, and so does deprivation.
Mm. And then it just keeps repeating the cycle.
Exactly.
Oh, so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a really, really great interview. You have just given us so much to think about. And this book, I mean, really is quite cutting edge. And wish you so much success with it. And that and that it really gets into the hands of the people that really need it. And I know that we could all probably use reading this book on some level, I'm sure.
It probably would benefit everyone.
Yeah.
To some extent, even if they're not a parent, they do have occasion to interact with children or young people, and what you say to a child goes in very deeply and stays there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Dr. Ewer, what is your website?
It's child2adultvictim.com.
Okay.
And the words are separated by hyphens.
Okay.
And two is T-O. So it's child2adultvictim.com.
Great. And can the book be purchased through your website?
Yes.
And you
have... In fact, there's a link on my website to Loving Healing Press.
Okay.
Actually, the best place to purchase my book is just to search for Loving Healing Press.
Okay.
I ought to have the website handy, but I don't. But I think it's lovinghealing.com or
yes.
something like that.
Yes, yes, it is. I have it actually right here up okay. in front of me, and it's lovinghealing.com. So is there a way for people to contact you through your website? Do you have your email address up there?
I certainly do.
Wonderful.
And my phone number and even my address.
Great, great.
And I encourage people to call and ask for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always happy to help. By being a priest, I've made my psychotherapy efforts and my efforts as an author a ministry.
Okay.
And this is the way I serve my church as a Christian counselor, but at the professional level.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find too many Christian counselors who have the credentials of a psychologist.
Yeah, that's really true. You have a very unique background and set of experiences, and it's just, it's really a magical mix, and your message is just, I can't speak enough about you and your book, you know, really.
Well,
I think it's fantastic.
Thank you so much. You're very kind.
Well, our time, Dr. Ewart, is really coming to an end here, so I wanted to make sure I got the website in, and I'm just going to let you share any final thoughts you would like to with listeners today.
Well, the main thing I'd like to get across is that if you are a victim of neglect, physical abuse, verbal abuse, or any kind of abuse, get some help, but don't go to just any therapist. Ask that therapist on the phone before you go whether he or she has any experience in treating abuse and what books they've read. Hopefully they've read at least my book, but they must be especially and specifically trained in treating abuse or they can't help you. And what happens in my field too often is that people go to a therapist for years and years and years, and nothing ever changes, but they just keep paying the money and going, and it doesn't make any sense. So don't do that.
Very wise words from a wise man. Thank you, Dr. Ewart.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too. God
bless. Bye-bye. All right, listeners, what a wonderful, wonderful interview today. So much great information. I've been talking with Dr. Hayward Ewart. His new book, Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. It is out now on Loving Healing Press. His website, once again, is childtoadultvictim.com. Each one of those words separated with a hyphen. Or you can go to lovinghealing.com. So thank you once again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson. And until next time.